Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of This Week in History with me, your host, Dan the Viking. Now, this week we have a slightly different episode. Now, those of you who are regular listeners to the show, cast your minds back. We did an episode probably about 6 to 8 months ago about the monarchs of England. We went through from William of Normandy in 1066 all the way up to Queen Elizabeth II, and we obviously missed out King Charles. I think we maybe mentioned King Charles III, but we covered almost 1,000-year history of the British royal timeline, and it got me thinking, is there another group of people in the world that are as famous as the royals in England? And after watching the news over the last few months and watching the presidential election race and things like that, I came to the conclusion that the presidents of America are probably on par, I would say, with the monarchs of England and Great Britain and obviously Ireland for some of them. And I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating to look back at all previous 46, 47 now presidents of the United States, and how much do I really know about these people, and how much do you guys know about the presidents of America? And we probably can pick a few names out of history, Teddy Roosevelt, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, that there are certain presidents in history that will spring to people's minds. And I thought, wouldn't it be brilliant to try and condense all of those down into one podcast? Now, this may be quite a long one because there is quite a lot of notes. And we're going to go through every president throughout the history of the United States. And we're going to cover a few, not all of them, but a few major points for each one. So we shall start with the first president of the United States, the British officer turned traitor to the British crown, George Washington. On April the 30th, 1789, George Washington, standing on the balcony of Federal Hall on Wall Street in New York, took his oath of office as the first president of the United States of America. George Washington was born in 1732 into a Virginia planter family, and he learned his morals, manners, and body of knowledge from his parents, and he was a general gentleman of the 18th century. He was probably one of the most upstanding people of his time, bearing in mind he did own slaves, but that's for another discussion. He pursued two intertwined interests in his youth, and they were military and Western expansion. At 16, he helped survey the Shenandoah lands for Thomas Lord Fairfax, and he was commissioned as a lieutenant colonel in 1754. He fought the first skirmishes of what grew into the French and Indian War, and in the next year, he was an aide to General Edward Braddock. He did escape injury, but he was shot at and ripped through his jacket 4 times. He also had 2 horses shot out from under him. So that's quite lucky, really. 6 bullets, any which could have killed him, but he remained unharmed. From 1759, the outbreak of the American Revolution, And Washington managed his lands around Mount Vernon and served in the Virginia House of Burgesses. He was married to a widow, Martha Dandridge Curtis, and he devoted himself to a busy and happy life. His fellow planters felt that he was exploited by British merchants and was hampered by British regulations. This essentially grew into a bit of an argument between him and his parents, and his country as well. You know, he saw himself at this point as an American, and he voiced his opinions quite loudly. The Second Congressional Congress was assembled in Philadelphia in 1775, and Washington, one of the Virginia delegates, was elected as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. On July the 3rd, 1775, at Cambridge, Massachusetts, he took command of his ill-trained troops and embarked upon a war that was to last 6 grueling years against the greatest empire the world had ever seen. He realized early that his best strategy was to harass the British. He reported to Congress, "We should on all occasions avoid general action or put anything to risk unless compelled by a necessity into which we ought never to be drawn." Essentially, it was a hit and run tactic. And that was kind of how the American Revolutionary War was fought. And it did work. I mean, it clearly worked. The ensuing battle saw him fall back slowly and then strike unexpectedly. Finally, in 1781, with the aid of French allies, he forced the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown. Washington wanted to retire and move back to his fields in Vermont, at Mount Vernon, but he soon realized that the nation under its Articles of Confederation was not functioning very well. So he became a prime mover in the steps leading to the Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia in 1787, when the new Constitution was ratified. The Electoral College unanimously elected Washington as the first president of America. Now, to his disappointment, two parties were developing towards the end of his term, and he was a bit weary of what was going to happen in the future. He felt old, and he retired at the end of his second term in office. In his farewell address, he urged his countrymen to forswear excessive party spirit and geographical distinctions in foreign affairs. He warned against long-term alliances, kind of like what Britain and America have right now. Washington enjoyed less than 3 years of retirement at Mount Vernon. He died of a throat infection on December the 14th, 1799. Now, he also put into there that no president should ever do more than 2 terms in office. I have just realized that we've spent 5 minutes talking about one president and we've got 47 to get through. So there may be a point here where we stop and revisit this for another episode. I don't want you guys, you know, to have a 2-hour episode. You might get a bit bored and not listen. We're going to move on. The second president of America, John Adams, a remarkable political philosopher, served as the second president of the United States from 1797 to 1801 after serving as vice president under George Washington. Learned and thoughtful, John Adams was more remarkable as a politician more remarkable as a philosopher than as a politician. "People and nations are forged in the fires of adversity," he said, doubtless taking upon what he'd experienced himself in the American Revolution. Adams was born in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1735. He was a Harvard-educated lawyer, and he early became identified with the Patriot system. He was a delegate to the First and Second Continental Congress, and he led the movement for independence. Now, you'll find there's a bit of a theme at the start of America that the gentlemen who were involved in the independence battle were probably the front runners for the first few presidents of America. During the Revolutionary War, he served in France and Holland as a diplomat. He helped negotiate the Treaty of Peace from 1785 to 1788, and he was minister to the Court of St. James, returning to be elected vice president under George Washington. Adams's two terms as vice president were frustrating experiences for a man of his vigour. He complained to his wife Abigail, "My country has in it its wisdom contrived for me the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived." Basically, he wasn't happy as vice president. He wanted more, and who can blame him? You know, you don't want to be number two, you want to be number one. When Adams became president, the war between the French and the British was causing great difficulties for the United States on the high seas, an intense partnership amongst contending factions within the nation. His administration focused on France, where the Directory, the ruling group, had refused to receive the American envoy and had suspended commercial relations. Adams sent three commissioners to France, but in the spring of 1798, word arrived that the French foreign minister, Talleyrand, and the Directory had refused to negotiate with them unless they would pay a substantial bribe. Adams reported the insults to Congress and the Senate, and the correspondence which the Frenchmen were to referred to as X, Y, and Z. So they wouldn't even say their names in Congress. You know, it was such an insult to America that the French had just snubbed them. The nation broke out into what Jefferson called the XYZ fever, increased by intensity by Adams' exhortations. The populace cheered itself wherever the president appeared. He was very, very popular back home because they'd used the French help to get the win, and then the French had just sort of thrown them away like a discarded tissue, and he sort of wasn't happy about that. And the American people loved the fact that their president said, "Do you know what? You might have helped us, but enough's enough. We're not going to be treated like fools. We are a brand new nation. We are a growing nation. And, you know, basically, don't treat us like that." And I suppose that attitude has passed on through all of America, because there's very few nations that feel they can insult Americans in that way. Congress appropriated money to complete three new frigates and to build additional ships. It authorized the raising of a provisional army, and it also passed the Alien and Sedations Act, intended to frighten foreign agents out of the country and to stifle the attacks of the Republican editors. President Adams did not call for a declaration of war, but hostilities did begin at sea. At first, American shipping was almost defenseless against the French privateers, but by 1800, armed merchantmen and US warships were clearing the sea lanes. Despite several brilliant naval victories, war fever subsided. Word came to Adams that France also had no stomach for war and would receive an envoy with respect. Long negotiations ended the quasi-war. I've just put quotations there, like you can see me doing the quotations, but obviously you can't. On November the 1st, 1800, just before the election, Adams arrived in the new capital city to take his residence in the White House. On his second evening in its damp, unfurnished rooms, he wrote to his wife, "Before I end my letter, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereby inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." Adams retired to his farm in Quincy, where he penned elaborate letters to Thomas Jefferson on the 4th of July, 1826. But he whispered his last words, "Thomas Jefferson survives." But Jefferson had actually died a few hours earlier, but he didn't know that. He died in Monticello a few hours before John Adams. But I find that very interesting. His last words were, "John Thomas Jefferson survives," but obviously Thomas Jefferson didn't survive. But that does bring us nicely onto the third president of America, Thomas Jefferson, a spokesman for democracy and was an American founding father, the principal author of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and the third president of the United States from 1801 to 1809. In the thick of a party conflict in the 1800, Thomas Jefferson wrote in a private letter, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal honesty against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." This powerful advocate of liberty was born in 1743 in Albemarle, someone tell me if I've said that wrong, Albemarle County in Virginia, inheriting from his father a planter and surveyor and some 5,000 acres of land. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm assuming there he was probably a slave owner as well. And from his mother, a Randolph High School standing. He studied at the College of William and Mary, then read law. In 1772, he married Martha Wales Skelton, a widow, and took her to live in this privately constructed mountaintop home in Monticello. Freckled and sandy-haired, rather tall and awkward, Jefferson was eloquent as a correspondent, but had no public speaker. He was not a very good public speaker, I should say. In the Virginia House of Burgesses and the Continental Congress, he contributed his pen rather than his voice to the patriot cause. As a silent member, done it again, quotation marks, you can't see. As a silent member of Congress, Jefferson at 33 drafted the Declaration of Independence. In the years following, he laboured to make his words a reality. Most notably, he wrote a bill establishing religious freedom that was enacted in 1786. Jefferson succeeded Benjamin Franklin as minister to France in 1785, and his sympathy for the French Revolution led him into conflict with Alexander Hamilton when Jefferson was Secretary of State in President Washington's cabinet. He resigned from that post in 1793. Sharp political conflict developed, and the two separate parties, the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, that's amazing, isn't it? The first parties were the Democratic Republicans, and now you have the Democrats and the Republicans. I find that fascinating. Jefferson gradually assumed leadership of the Republicans, who sympathised with the revolutionary cause in France. Attacking Federalist policies, he opposed a strong centralised government and championed the rights of individual states. As a reluctant candidate for president in 1796, Jefferson came within 3 votes of election. The flaw in the Constitution, he became vice president. So I don't know how that worked, but there was obviously a flaw in the Constitution at that time, and he became vice president, although the opponent became President Adams. In 1800, the defeat caused a more serious problem. Republican electors attempting to name both a president and a vice president from their own party can cast a tie vote between Jefferson and Aaron Burr. The House of Representatives settled the tie. Hamilton, disliking both Jefferson and Burr, urged Jefferson's election. When Jefferson assumed the presidency, the crisis in France had passed. He slashed army and navy expenditure, cut the budget, eliminated the tax on whiskey, which was very unpopular, as I'm sure you can imagine, but yet he reduced the national debt by a third. He also sent a naval squadron to fight the Barbary pirates who were harassing the American commerce in the Mediterranean. Although the Constitution made no provisions for the acquisition of new land, Jefferson suppressed his qualms over constitutionally when he had the opportunity to acquire the Louisiana Territory from Napoleon in 1803. During Jefferson's second term, he was increasingly preoccupied with keeping the nation from involvement in the Napoleonic Wars, though both England and France interfered with the neutral rights of American merchantmen. Jefferson's attempted solution, an embargo upon American shipping, worked badly and was very unpopular. Jefferson retired to Monticello to ponder such projects as his grand designs for a university in Virginia. A French nobleman observed that he had placed his house and his mind on an elevated situation from which he might contemplate the universe. He also died on the 4th of July, 1826. That leads us to the fourth president of the United States, James Madison, America's fourth president from 1809 to 1817. Now, he made a major contribution to the ratification of the Constitution by writing the Federalist Papers along with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay. In later years, he was referred to as the father of the Constitution. At his inauguration, James Madison, a small Napoleon-sized man, we'll say, appeared old and worn. Washington Irving described him as but a withered little Apple John. That's not really a nice way of saying it. But whatever he lacked in his charm, he was made up for by his wife Dolly. She had a warmth and gentle approach, and she was the toast of Washington. She was a very popular character. Just goes to show that the First Lady can be the winning edge in certain situations. Born in 1751, Madison was brought up in Orange County, Virginia. Seeing a bit of a pattern here, Virginia seems very popular for presidents. And attended Princeton. It was then called the College of New Jersey, but it's obviously now it's Princeton. A student of history and government, well-read in law, he participated in the framing of the Virginia Constitution in 1776 and served in the Congressional Congress. He was a leader in the Virginia Assembly. When delegates to the Constitutional Convention assembled at Philadelphia, the then 36-year-old Madison took frequent but an empathetic part in the debates. Madison made a major contribution to the ratification of the Constitution by writing with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay the Federalist Essays. In later years, when he was referred to as the father of the Constitution, Madison protested that the document was not the offspring of a single brain, but the work of many heads and many hands. In Congress, he helped frame the Bill of Rights and enact the first revenue legislation out of his leadership, in opposition to Hamilton's financial proposals, which he felt would unduly bestow wealth and power upon Northern financiers. This is what came the development of the Republican, or the Jeffersonian Party, as it was known. As President Jefferson's Secretary of State, Madison protested to warring France and Britain that their seizure of American ships was contrary to international law. Despite the unpopular Embargo Act of 1807, which did not make the belligerent nations change their ways, but did cause a depression in the United States, Madison was elected president in 1808, before he took office and the Embargo Act was repealed. During the first year of Madison's administration, the United States prohibited trade with both Britain and France. Then in May 1810, Congress authorized trade with both, directing the president, if either would accept America's view of neutral rights, to forbid trade with the other nation. Napoleon pretended to comply. Late in 1810, Madison proclaimed non-intercourse with Great Britain. In Congress, a young group called, including Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun, they were known as the War Hawks, pressed the president for a more militant policy to what was being seen overseas. The British impressment of American seamen and the seizure of cargoes impelled Madison to give in to the pressure that he was seeing. And on June 1812, he asked Congress to declare war. The young Napoleon was not prepared to fight. Its forces had taken severe trouncing, and the British entered Washington and set fire to the White House and the Capitol. I know you guys class the War of 1812 as a victory. It wasn't a victory. Go back and listen to the episode on the War of 1812. You declared war on us. You sued for peace. You lost the war. Regardless of anything else, I mean, that's just standard military strategy, isn't it? I mean, I'm going to go a bit off on a tangent here because this does bug me, because I get this a lot from Americans. Now, we've beaten you in two wars and you haven't. You've beaten us in one war. We've beaten you in one war. The War of 1812, it's not a draw. It wasn't a stalemate. You invaded Canada. You wanted the lands. You lost. You got beaten back. And then we burnt the White House to the ground. That's a pretty comprehensive victory. Now, you can argue with me till the hills come home, but you'll have to go back and listen to the episode. Now, I do go off on a bit of a tangent there, but it is one thing. It is one thing that does get me. There were a few notable naval and military victories, however, for the Americans, climaxed by General Andrew Jackson and his triumph at New Orleans. Again, you'd already surrendered at this point. So this is the big thing. I mean, there's actually a song called The Battle of New Orleans by Johnny Horton. Is one of my favourite songs. We fired our guns and the British kept to come in. There wasn't half as many as there was a while ago. It's a great song. If you've not listened to it, go and listen to it. But yeah, they made out that this was this glory-defining battle. But America had actually already conceded the war. They just hadn't got the note in New Orleans. It was a good victory, but kind of pointless. However, what it did do is it did give an upsurge in nationalism. The New England Federalists, who had opposed the war and who had even talked about secession, were so basically overwhelmed by this victory in New Orleans and how America had done that the Federalism disappeared as a national party. In retirement at Montpelier, his estate in Orange County, Virginia, Madison spoke out against the disruptive states' rights influence that the 1830s threatened to shatter the Federal Union. In a note opened after his death in 1836, he stated, "The advice nearest to my heart and deepest in my convictions is that the Union of the United States should be cherished and perpetuated." So, almost saying that he knew that this war was coming. He knew. Something about him knew that there was going to be a civil war. The fifth president of the United States, James Monroe. He was the fifth president from 1817 to 1825, and he was the last president from the Founding Fathers. On New Year's Day, 1825, at the last of his annual White House receptions, President James Monroe made a pleasing impression upon a Virginia lady who shook his hand. "He is tall and well-formed, his dress plain in the old style. His manner was quite quiet and dignified. From the frank, honest expression of his eye, I think he well deserves the encomium passed upon him by the great Jefferson, who said Monroe was so honest that if you turned his soul inside out, there would not be a spot on it." So, basically, probably the first and last honest politician. Born in Westmoreland County, guess what state, in Virginia, in 1758, Monroe attended the College of William and Mary, fought with distinction in the Continental Army, and practiced law in Fredericksburg, Virginia. As a youthful politician, he joined the Anti-Federalists in the Virginia Convention, which ratified the Constitution. And in 1790, an advocate of Jefferson's policies was elected as United States Senator. As a minister of France in 1794 to 1796, he displayed strong sympathies for the French cause. Later, with Robert R. Livingston, he helped to negotiate the Louisiana Purchase. Now, I tell you what, the Louisiana Purchase, that would be a very interesting subject, so I might have to do that one in the near future. His ambition and energy, together with the backing of President Madison, made him the Republican choice for presidency in 1816, with little Federalist opposition. He won re-election easily in 1820, and Monroe made an unusually strong cabinet choice, naming a Southerner, John C. Calhoun, as Secretary of War, and Northerner John Quincy Adams as Secretary of State. Only Henry Clay's refusal kept Monroe from adding an outstanding Westerner to his cabinet. He was basically trying to unite the entire country, which was quite a good policy, really, when you consider the four runs that happened after that. But early in his administration, Monroe undertook a goodwill tour at Boston. His visit was hailed as the beginning of an era of good feelings. Unfortunately, these good feelings didn't last. Although Monroe, his popularity undiminished, followed by national policies. Across the facade of nationalism, ugly cracks started to appear. A painful economic depression undoubtedly increased the dismay of the people of the Missouri Territory in 1819, when their application for admission to the Union as a slave state failed. An amended bill gradually eliminating slavery in Missouri precipitated 2 years of bitter debate in Congress. The Missouri Compromise Bill resolved the struggle, pairing Missouri as a slave state with Maine, a free state, and barring slavery North and West Missouri forever. In foreign affairs, Monroe proclaimed the fundamental policy that bears his name, responding to the threat that the more conservative governments in Europe might try to aid Spain in winning back her former Latin American colonies. Monroe did not begin formally to recognize these young sister republics until 1822, after asserting that Congress would vote apparitions for diplomatic missions only. He and the Secretary of State John Quincy Adams wished to avoid trouble with Spain until it had seceded the Floridas, as well was done in 1821. Great Britain, with its powerful navy, also opposed reconquest of Latin America and suggested the United States join the proclaiming hands-off. Ex-presidents Jefferson and Madison counseled Monroe to accept the offer, but Secretary Adams advised it would be more candid to avow our principles explicitly to Russia and France than to come as a cockboat in the wake of the British man of war. Not sure exactly what that means, but that's a quote. Monroe accepted Adams' advice. Not only must Latin America be left alone, he warned, but also Russia must not.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Not encroach southwards on the Pacific coast, the American continents, he stated, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European power. Basically, this was when America started to show themselves on the world stage. They were the big I am. They were turning into the power that we know now. This actually became known as the Monroe Doctrine, and it was probably what he was most famous for in his tenure as President of America. He actually died 20 years later in 1831. Now we move on to the sixth president. One I have heard of, a couple of them I hadn't heard of, so a bit of research needed to be done there. The next one we are talking about is John Quincy Adams. Son of John and Abigail Adams, served as the sixth president of the United States from 1825 to 1829. Now, he was a member of multiple political parties over the years, and he also served as a diplomat, a senator, and member of the House of Representatives. So quite a distinguished career for a politician. The first president who was the son of a president, John Quincy Adams, in many respects paralleled the career as well as the temperament and viewpoints of his illustrious father. Born in Braintree, Massachusetts in 1767, he watched the Battle of Bunker Hill from the top of Penn's Hill above the family farm. As secretary to his father in Europe, he became an accomplished linguist and an assiduous diarist. So for those of you who don't know, that means he wrote a very compelling diary. After graduating from Harvard, he became a lawyer. At age 26, he was appointed minister to the Netherlands and then promoted to the Berlin legation. In 1802, he was elected to the United States Senate. 6 years later, President Madison appointed him to be minister of Russia. Serving under President Monroe, Adams was one of America's great secretaries of state, arranging with England for the joint occupation of the Oregon County, obtaining from Spain the secession of the Floridas, and formulating with the President of Monroe Doctrine. The political tradition of the early 19th century, Adams as Secretary of State was considered the political heir to the presidency, but the old ways of choosing a president were given in 1824 before the popular choice. Within the one and only party, the Republican Party, sectionalism and factionalism were developing, and each of these sections put up its own candidate for the presidency. Adams, the candidate for the North, fell behind General Andrew Jackson in both popular and electoral votes, but received more than William H. Crawford and Henry Clay. Since no candidate had a majority of electoral votes, the election was decided amongst the top three by the House of Representatives. Clay was favored a program similar to that of Adams through his crucial support in the House of the New Englander. In other words, he wouldn't have won the election if it wasn't for the system that America had in place at the time. Essentially, it should have gone to General Andrew Jackson, but it didn't. Upon becoming president, Adams appointed Clay as Secretary of State. Jackson and his angry followers charged that a corrupt bargain had taken place and immediately began their campaign to wrest the presidency from Adams in 1828. Well aware that he would face hostility in Congress, Adams nevertheless proclaimed in his first annual message a spectacular national program. He proposed that the federal government bring the sections together with a network of highways and canals, and that it develop and conserve the public domain using the funds from the sale of public lands. And in 1828, he broke ground for the 185-mile C&O Canal. Adams urged the United States to take a lead in development of the arts and sciences through establishment of national universities, the financing of scientific expeditions, and the erection of an observatory. His critics declared such measures transcended constitutional limitations. In the campaign of 1828, in which Jacksonian opponents charged him with corruption and public plunder, was an ordeal Adams did not easily bear. After his defeat, he returned to Massachusetts, expecting to spend the remainder of his life in his farm and with his books. Unexpectedly, in 1830, the Plymouth District elected him to the House of Representatives, and there, for the remainder of his life, he served as a powerful leader. Above all, he fought against circumscription of civil liberties. In 1838, Southern congressmen passed a gag rule, providing that the House automatically table petitions against slavery. Adams tirelessly fought the rule for 8 years until he finally obtained its repeal. In 1848, he collapsed on the floor of the House from a stroke and was carried to the Speaker's room, where 2 days later he died. He was buried alongside his father, mother, and wife at the First Parish Church in Quincy. To the end, Old Man Eloquent had fought for what he considered right. I'm going to go to 10, I think, with this, just so you know, because I've just realised the time on this. And it is actually very, very interesting, but we're only at number 7 and we're 40 minutes in. So we're going to go for number 7, Andrew Jackson. Again, a very famous president. He was the 7th president of the United States from 1829 to 1837, seeking to act as the direct representative of the common man, what we want in a president. More nearly than any of his predecessors, Andrew Jackson was elected by popular vote. As president, he sought to act the direct representative of the common man. Born in Blackwood Settlement in the Carolinas in 1767, he received a sporadic education, but in his late teens, he read law for about 2 years and became an outstanding young lawyer in Tennessee. Fiercely jealous of his honor, he engaged in brawls and in a duel killed a man who cast an unjustified slur, on his wife Rachel. So, pretty good with a gun, pretty quick with a temper. I mean, to shoot a man over an insult, maybe probably not considered correct anymore, but that was the law back then. Jackson proposed sufficiently to buy slaves and to build a mansion, the Hermitage near Nashville. He was the first man elected from Tennessee to the House of Representatives, and he served briefly in the Senate. A major general in the War of 1812, Jackson became a national hero when he defeated the British at New Orleans. Like I said, after the war had ended. In 1824, some state political factions rallied around Jackson, and by 1828, enough had joined Old Hickory to win numerous state elections and control the federal administration in Washington. In his first annual message to Congress, Jackson recommended eliminating the Electoral College. He also tried to democratize federal office holdings. Already, state machines were beginning to build on patronage, and a New York senator proclaimed that to the victors belong the spoils, a very famous quote. Didn't actually know it came from America, so there you go. Jackson took a milder view, decrying office holders who seemed to enjoy life tenure. He believed government duties should be so plain and simple that the offices should rotate among deserving applicants. As national politics polarized around Jackson and his opposition, two parties grew out of the old Republican Party. The Democratic Republicans, or the Democrats, adhering to Jackson, and the National Republicans, or Whigs, which were opposing them. Now, Whigs is a British term for the opposition to the Conservative government at the time in London. Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and other Whig leaders proclaimed themselves defenders of popular liberties against the usurpation of Jackson. Hostile cartoonists portrayed him as King Andrew I, and behind their accusations lay the fact that Jackson, unlike previous presidents, did not defer to Congress in policy making, but used his power and the power of veto and his party leadership to assume command. The greatest party battle centered around the Second Bank of the United States, a private corporation, but virtually a government-sponsored monopoly. When Jackson appeared hostile towards it, the bank threw its power against him, which they do now. Clay and Webster, who had acted as attorneys for the bank, led the fight for its recharter in Congress. Jackson told Martin Van Buren, "It's trying to kill me, but I will kill it." Jackson, in vetoing the recharter bill, charged the bank with undue economic privilege. His views won approval from the American electorate. In 1832, he polled more than 56% of the popular vote, almost five times as many electoral votes as Clay. Jackson met head-on the challenge of John C. Calhoun, leader of the forces trying to rid themselves of high protective tariff. When South Carolina undertook to nullify the tariff, Jackson ordered armed forces to Charleston and privately threatened to hang Calhoun. Violence seemed imminent until Clay negotiated a compromise. Tariffs were lowered and South Carolina dropped nullification. In 1832, while the president was dining with his friends at the White House, someone whispered to him that the Senate had rejected the nomination of Martin Van Buren as minister to England. Jackson jumped to his feet and exclaimed, "By the eternal, I'll smash them." So he did. His favorite, Van Buren, became vice president and succeeded to the presidency when Old Hickory retired to Hermitage, where he died in June 1845. So, we know the name of the 8th president, Martin Van Buren. And Martin Van Buren was the 8th president of the United States from 1837 to 1841, after serving as the 8th vice president and the 10th secretary of state, both under President Andrew Jackson. While the country was prosperous, the Little Magician was elected. Less than 3 months later, the final panic of 1837 punctured the prosperity. Only about 5'6" tall, but trim and erect, Martin Van Buren dressed fastidiously. What annoys me about this is they say 5'6" like it's a bad thing. I'm 5'6", doesn't make a difference how tall you are. His impeccable appearance belied his ambition and his humble background. Of Dutch descent, he was born in 1782, the son of a tavern keeper and farmer in Kinderhook, New York. As a young lawyer, he became involved in New York politics as leader of the Albany Regency, an effective New York political organization. He shrewdly dispensed public offices and bounty in the fashion calculated to bring votes. Yet he faithfully fulfilled official duties and in 1821 was elected to the United States Senate. By 1827, he had emerged as the principal northern leader for Andrew Jackson. President Jackson rewarded Van Buren by appointing him Secretary of State. As the cabinet members appointed at John C. Calhoun's recommendation began to demonstrate only secondary loyalty to Jackson, Van Buren emerged as the president's most trusted advisor. Jackson referred to him as a true man with no guile. The rift in the cabinet became serious because of Jackson's differences with Calhoun, a presidential aspirant. Van Buren suggested a way out of an eventual impasse. He and Secretary of War Eaton resigned so that Calhoun and his men would also resign. Jackson appointed a new cabinet and sought again to reward Van Buren by appointing him Minister to Great Britain. Vice President Calhoun and President of the Senate cast the deciding vote against the appointment and made a martyr of Van Buren. The little magician was elected vice president on the Jacksonian ticket in 1832, and again he won the presidency in 1836. Van Buren devoted his inaugural address to disclose upon the American experiment as an example to the rest of the world. The country was prosperous, but less than 3 months later, the panic of 1837 punctured the prosperity. Basically, the trouble was the 19th century economy of boom and bust, which was following its regular pattern, but Jackson's financial measures contributed to the crash. His destruction of the Second Bank of the United States had removed restrictions upon the inflationary prices of some statute banks. Basically, his policies going against the bankers caused the crash, and Van Buren just happened to be vice president at the time, and then when he's taken over, this crash has really hit into power. To the end of this speculation, Jackson in 1836 had issued a special circular requiring that the lands be purchased with hard money, gold or silver, not banknotes, only gold or silver. In 1837, the panic began. Hundreds of banks and businesses failed. Thousands lost their lands. For about 5 years, the United States was racked by the worst depression thus far in history. Van Buren basically did nothing to help the depression, and declaring that the panic was due to recklessness in business and overexpansion of credit, Van Buren devoted himself to maintaining the solvency of the national government. He opposed not only the creation of a new Bank of the United States, but also placing of government funds in state banks. He fought for the establishment of an independent treasury system to handle government transactions, as for federal aid to internal improvements. He cut off expenditures so completely that the government even sold the tools it had used on public works. Inclined more and more to oppose the expansion of slavery, Van Buren blocked the annexation of Texas, because it was assuredly evident that it would become a slave territory and it might bring a war with Mexico. He was defeated by the Whigs in 1840 for re-election and was an unsuccessful candidate for president on the Free Soil ticket in 1848. He died in 1862. We go to number 9 now. William Henry Harrison, an American military officer and politician, was the 9th president of the United States in 1841. The oldest president to be elected at the time, on his 32nd day, he became the first president to die in office, serving the shortest tenure in US presidential history. Give him a hard barrel of cider and settle a pension of $2,000 a year on him. My word for it. A Democratic newspaper foolishly gibed. He will sit by the side of a sea coal fire and study moral philosophy. The Whigs, seizing on this political misstep in 1840, presented their candidate William Henry Harrison as a simple frontier Indian fighting, living in a log cabin and drinking cider. In a sharp contrast to the aristocratic champagne-sipping Van Buren, Harris was in fact a Virginia planter. He was from an aristocracy. He was born in Berkeley, 1773, and he studied classics and history at Hampton Sidney College, and then began to study medicine in Richmond. The same year, in 1791, Harrison switched interests, and he obtained a commission as an ensign in the 1st Infantry of the Regular Army and headed to the northwest, where he spent much of his life. His prime task as governor was to obtain the title of Indian lands so settlers could press forward into the wilderness. When the Indians retaliated, Harrison was responsible for defending the settlements. The threat against settlers became serious in 1809. An eloquent and energetic chieftain, I'm not going to try and pronounce that, T-E-C-U-M-S-E-H, anyone who can pronounce that, let me know, with his brother, the Prophet, began to strengthen an Indian confederation to prevent further encroachment, and in 1811, Harrison received permission to attack the Confederacy. There's not much to him. In the War of 1812, Harrison won more military laurels when he was given the command of the army in the northwest with the rank of Brigadier General. At the Battle of the Thames, north of Lake Erie, on October the 5th, 1813, he defeated the combined British and Indian forces, and he actually killed Tecumseh, I've tried to pronounce it. The Indians scattered, never to again offer serious resistance to the northwest. So he had a bit of military history to him and was probably quite a popular candidate, especially by the fact that they sort of advertised him as this frontiersman, this normal bloke, basically. And that was how they portrayed him. But before he'd been in office for a month, he actually caught a cold, which developed into pneumonia. And on April the 4th, 1841, he died. He was the first president to die in office. And unfortunately, with him died the Whig program. So we'll move to number 10 and we shall end it here. We're going to go 10, 1 to 10, 11 to 20. 21 to 30, 30 to 40, and then we're going to finish with the last few. John Tyler became the 10th president of the United States. He was president from 1841 to 1845, and when President William Henry Harrison died in 1841, he was the first vice president to succeed to the presidency after the death of his predecessor. Dubbed his accidency by his detractors, John Tyler was the first president who had ever basically been pushed into the presidential role because of the death of a successor. Born in Virginia in 1790, this is another Virginian, he was raised believing that the Constitution must be strictly constructed. He was never wavered from his conviction, and he attended the College of William and Mary and studied law. Serving in the House of Representatives from 1816 to 1821, Tyler voted against most nationalist legislation and opposed the Missouri Compromise. After leaving the House, he served as governor of Virginia. As a senator, he reluctantly supported Jackson for president, as the lesser of two evils. Tyler soon joined the state's rights Southerners in Congress, who banded with Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and their newly formed Whig Party opposing President Jackson. The Whigs nominated Tyler for vice president in 1840, hoping for support from the southern states. So the slogan was Tippin Co. and Tyler Too. I'm not sure what that means, but that was their slogan. Implied the flag-waving nationalism plus a dash of southern sectionalism. Clay intended to keep party leadership in his own hands, minimized his nationalist views temporarily. Webster complained himself a Jeffersonian Democrat. But after the election, both men tried to dominate old Tippin Co. Suddenly, President Harrison was dead and Tyler, too, was in the White House. After the first year, the Whigs were not too disturbed, although Tyler insisted upon assuming the full powers of the duly elected president. He delivered an inaugural address, but it seemed to seemed just full of Whig doctrine. Whigs, optimistic that Tyler would accept their program, were soon disillusioned. Tyler was ready to compromise on the banking question, but Clay would not budge. He would not accept Tyler's exchequer system, and Tyler vetoed Clay's bill to establish a national bank with branches in several states. A similar bank bill was passed by Congress, but again on states' rights grounds, Tyler vetoed it. In retaliation, the Whigs expelled Tyler from their party, all the cabinet resigned, but the Secretary of State, he was the only one left. A year later, when Tyler vetoed a tariff bill, the first impeachment resolution against the president was introduced in the House of Representatives. A committee headed by Representative John Quincy Adams reported that the president had misused the veto power, but the resolution failed. Despite their differences, President Tyler and the Whig Congress enacted much positive legislation. The Log Cabin Bill enabled a settler to claim 160 acres of land before it was offered publicly for sale, and later pay $1.25 an acre for it. Tyler did sign a tariff bill blocking northern manufacturers, and the Webster-Ashburton Treaty ended a Canadian boundary dispute, and in 1845, Texas was annexed. The administration of the states' rights, but it also increased sectional cleavage that led towards the Civil War. By the end of his term, Tyler had replaced the original Whig cabinet with Southern conservatives. Calhoun became Secretary of State, and later these men returned to the Democratic Party, committed to the preservation of states' rights and the institution of slavery. The Whigs became more representative of northern businesses and farming interests. When the first southern state seceded in 1861, Tyler led a compromise movement. Failing, he worked to create the Southern Confederacy, and he died in 1862, a member of the Confederate House of Representatives. So we will leave it there this week. This is the first 10 presidents of the United States of America. You will have to join me next week to get numbers 11 to 20. I hope you did enjoy that. The research that has gone into this is massive, and it's really, really interesting. Just finding out about these names that we do know over here. You know, there are a lot of people that know American politicians. They know some of the names from history, but they don't necessarily know their achievements. I'm sure a lot of Americans are listening to this sort of going, yeah, I know this. But I find it absolutely fascinating, and I hope you guys do too. And I hope you do join me next week when we elaborate on this and we go for the next 10. I'm going to try and get these episodes out quite regularly now, because I have got, I've done the research onto this, and it shouldn't take too long to record all of these episodes. So hopefully we've got a few coming up. I have got a special guest coming next week, and I do believe my dad has a fantastic episode for all you Australian listeners. We actually have a bit of Australian history coming your way as well. So absolutely fantastic. Looking forward to the next few weeks. Hopefully having a big flourish of podcasts coming up your way just before Christmas. So that's the plan. If you haven't listened to us regularly or you don't know, go back to some of the episodes that were mentioned previously, because there are some really good ones out there. Like I said, the War of 1812 is fantastic. One of my favourite episodes ever to record, especially because you're getting a British side of it rather than the American side that you probably learn in school. So for all of you out there, you know, I do hope you join us again. These episodes will be going on Patreon first. You'll probably find in the next couple of days the whole collection of the presidents will be on Patreon, but they will be going out sporadically over the next couple of weeks. So if you do want to listen to the next episode, you do have to get yourselves onto Patreon. I want to give a big shout out to our new Patreon members, Bill and Christy. Thank you so much for joining the Patreon. It means the world to me. You guys on Patreon are the absolute world to this podcast. And this is how, to be honest, this is one of the main reasons why there hasn't been many episodes going out on the free feed, because a lot of people do think we make quite a bit of money off podcasts. I know there are podcasters out there that make quite a bit of money, but I'll just give you an idea. It costs me $12 a month to host this podcast, to actually have the company upload these to all the servers and all the podcasting apps across the network. And last month, I think I made $13.50. So that's a profit of $1.50. For those of you who are English, it's roughly a pound a month is what I make for doing these podcasts. So if it wasn't for Patreon, we wouldn't be doing the podcast at all. And this is one of the main reasons why I'm just not finding the time to do these podcasts, because as horrible as it sounds, it's not worth the time and effort that goes in to make a pound a month. You know, as you can imagine, this episode is over an hour long. The research that's gone into it is days, if not weeks. And yeah, it's one of them things. And it's something that all podcasters struggle with at the beginning. But I mean, this is quite a recognized podcast. We've been going sort of nearly 3 years now. So I don't ever begrudge people just listening to the free feed. It's fantastic. But if you want to help this podcast grow so that I do have the ability to do more podcasts, you can join Patreon. You don't have to join Patreon. One of the best ways to do it is to like and share and subscribe this podcast. Share it to your friends. Share it to your family. And just subscribe. You know, whatever app you're on, subscribe to it, because those subscriptions class as downloads and it increases the value of the podcast. So I don't like to be a podcaster that bangs on about money, because I don't really do it for the money. But obviously, it does have to be worth the time that we put in. But all of that aside, join us next week. We will have the next 10 presidents of the United States. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them.
Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.